Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Jim and Austin, good to have you together again. Austin's been on leave for a while and is back with us. The Iran thing has really started up. There's been a number of other revolutions. I guess the Iran is being the green revolution. Our friends over at Instapundit have actually changed their site to green to show their solidarity. Since we're camouflage color, we're already green. So
we're whatever you want us to be. Anyway, go ahead.
Right. But there have been a number. There's been some of these other color named revolutions out there. What were they, Jim?
There aren't too many. You know, they're going to start running out of colors pretty soon. There was the Orange Revolution 2 years back in the Ukraine. There was the Velvet Revolution. Yeah, I guess we can go by touchy feely, you know, angle in Czechoslovakia. And there have been numerous. Again, we were discussing this before we went on the air. And the point I brought up, as far as I can recollect, so this isn't 100% perfect, none of these post-police state mass revolutions has failed. Now, let me qualify that, because a lot of people are saying, what, post-police state? The communists, one of their dubious achievements, was they perfected the police state. We've gone into that in many places in Strategy Page, but they basically wrote the book. The Nazis picked up, and the Nazis always openly, well, not so openly, but they admitted to each other that the Stalin is doing a better job of creating and running a police state than even the Nazis were. Despite that, and to the surprise of many people in 1989-91, this perfect police state could not withstand basically the majority of people standing up and saying, no, we're not going to take it anymore. Now, as all of us students of history know, nothing is perfect. And what we have to watch for, what Austin was pointing out during, again, before we started here, was that there's always going to be a first time. And so, you know, we're watching Iran very intently because it's not a socialist police state. In other words, it's not a secular police state. It's a religious police state. And that might be, you know, the extra ingredient. You know, if you're going to have a perfect police state, get the clergy on your side. I don't know if that's even possible. But anyway, Iran has history going for it right now. But there's a catch. It's not exactly like the others. And that might make the difference.
We can come back and explore that. Jim's really hitting something that's very, very important, why Iran is different. But let me bring up some failed revolts since 1950, really. When we discussed on Strategy Talk several weeks ago in May, about May of 1989, and I pointed out the East Germans throwing rocks in 1953, the Hungarian revolt, and it was an outright revolt, an armed revolt in 1956, and it's put down by the Soviets. Then there are also the springs. We've had the colored revolution, and as Jim said, I've never quite heard it put that way. The Velvet Revolution is the touchy-feely revolution there in Czechoslovakia. He was right. He's right. That's a good way of putting it. That was kind of a unique circumstance, I think. But look at Prague Spring in the late 1960s. That was put down by a Soviet invasion. Beirut Spring. Now, Beirut Spring, it might be a analog that from 2005 that we could use in some discussion about Iran, even though Lebanon is very, very demographically and historically different than Iran. And you had at the forefront of Beirut Spring in 2005 angry Christian and Sunni Arab elites, educated, connected to Europe, a good understanding, if not a superior understanding, of information conflict, information warfare is probably stressing it. It was political information warfare. Remember all the pictures of all the beautiful girls? We do have that showing up in the Green Revolution in Iran. I know many of them are wearing Islamic garb, but that they have gorgeous eyes, and we've had more than a few very beautiful Iranian women featured in on the internet and even showing up on broadcast and cable television. I noticed that, and I thought that's a resonance of what the Lebanese were up to in 2005. There are failed revolts. 1989, June 1989, Tiananmen Square, even though that was not a revolt, it was demonstrations. I suppose one could apply in this.
Yeah, let me jump in with one qualify here. I said mass revolt. In all those revolts, you know, before the 1980s, you still had a large chunk of the population believed in communism. Dubček in Czechoslovakia.
That's true. That's
and
right.
Anofi knows people personally who were involved in the Hungarian one, in senior positions. A lot of the population simply wanted to modify, you know, communism to better suit their needs. Now that went out the window by the 1980s. That's what I said. We're talking about a revolution where the majority of the people, a vast majority of the people, stand up and say, enough, the system we have here, it sucks, it's gotta go, and we don't give a damn.
Well, and here's the touchstone on that, Jim, where we agree. I'm just pointing out failed, you know, those situations where, quote unquote, it didn't work and there wasn't a mass majority willing to confront
that was the difference in the late 80s. I mean, that surprised people because in the late 80s, I remember people bringing up Czechoslovakia and Hungary. But the kicker there was when the word started coming out that Gorbachev told the communist rulers in Eastern Europe, I'm not going to send my army in. Now, we saw that earlier. That first started in the mid-80s, in the early 80s, when Poland was on the precipice of doing, you know, another of that Prague Spring-type revolution. But the Poles explained to the Russians that, you know, it's not Czechoslovakia. Most of the people here are against it. If you send the army in, it's bloodbath. Now, the Russians backed off there. See, that was critical. Even the Russians were losing their nerve. The big difference in Iran is that you have the religion is not just a big chunk of the population is Islamic conservatives, but you have the Basij, you have hundreds of thousands of young guys with guns who are believers. They're willing to kill their people. And that's what might turn, you know, the Green Revolution into a replay of what happened in Germany and Hungary in the 1950s.
Well, yeah. Look, Jim, here's something also to consider, and this is something that we actually touched on in our little pre-talk before we went on the air, and that is how you can see Marxism and communism as a faith structure, a religion. And they people had lost faith. They knew it didn't work by the end of the 1980s. Now,
yeah.
I recall a conversation you and I had 14 years ago in 1995. I didn't bring this up earlier, but I remember when we were working on the 1996 edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War. And one of the things I had looked at was an analysis. It may have actually been written by Michael Ledeen, now that I think about it, Iranian expert that works for American Enterprise Institute now, but it was, you know, the Iranians are disenchanted with the revolution. It doesn't put bread on the table. But your point was they aren't ready. All those elements are there, but they're not ready to confront in the streets. I mean, and then that's a 14-year-old conversation. But I thought about it, and again, Jim was right. You had those elements, and you can actually go back and look at the 1996 edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War and look at the Iran chapter, and that element, we addressed that element in that chapter in the 1996 edition. What's changed over the last 14 years? Well, 14 years of increased corruption, and that's documentable, the increased corruption by the mullahocracy, failure, economic failure in Malays, and then another point. And I think it was 2000, Khatami got elected accidentally. Remember the Ayatollah Khatami, who's really a philosophy professor?
Yeah.
He was supposed to lose. He got 75 or 76% of the vote, which scared the heck out of the Khamenei mullahs, the guys who are really running the situation. So then they changed their quote-unquote, it was really a kind of fake democracy. They turned it into a completely fake system where they choose all of the candidates because they didn't want to be embarrassed to have yes, he's religiously conservative, but Khatami was Ayatollah Khatami, really within the mullahs, the clerical structure there in Iran, as a out-and-out liberal that didn't like a lot of things about the system because it didn't feed the people and didn't meet their needs, and the people voted for him because they knew he was the protest candidate. Well, they got rid of that, and another change since 1995. In 2005, they changed the way their already semi-fake democracy. They turned it into their elections into a complete fake. That's part of what has it matured yet? Has it driven it to the point that mass demonstrations become mass revolt? To get back to Jim's point, we don't know that, but we are approaching a point in this, and I'm about to give a scenario, but I'd be interested in Jim's feedback on this. It's one I've done on a couple of other radio programs in the last 10 days talking about Iran. And that is, I say we're still in the anger and demonstration in the street mode, personal ambition, when Mousavi is an example, but also, you know, the Ayatollah Khamenei, those are all in play. Fissures have been exposed within the mullahs. You see some who are more nationalist instead of the internationalist Islamic revolutionary Khomeiniist, as in the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the leader of the 1979 revolution. There are splits in there. But we've also seen the Basij and the militias and the police effectively put down demonstrations. That's happened within the last 48 hours. And we've moved to a situation where I say over the next 10 days, watch this. Are the people going to make the decision to make the move that Jim says, where it's mass confrontation and willing to spend blood in the streets, or has the repression element set in? In other words, we'll go out to 3 weeks, 3 weeks plus since the election. Is it being sustained in the streets? Is it being sustained politically? Is it being sustained in the information war between demonstrators and the mullah government? We don't know, but this is really a critical time.
Yeah.
Well, what I'm getting from our contacts in Iran and in the area, because at least one of the guys in Kuwait is part Iranian, or anyway, he has a lot of friends in Iran. I think he has a business which trades with Iran. They tell me that the problem right now, obviously messages are getting in and out, is that the people who are at the forefront of the resistance, as it were, are the urban elites, the effete snobs in northern Tehran, as one guy described it. obviously, you know something about American history. But there are a lot of people throughout the country. Remember, about 35% of Iranians have internet access. That's one of the highest penetrations of internet access in the Middle East. They have that oil, and although the corruption, you know, the country is somewhat advanced, and they were always a little ahead of the Arabs, you know, which is why Iran has run the area, so to speak, you know, for thousands of years. But it's a near-run thing, because even the people inside, you know, they're trying to convince people on the fence. I mean, even the people in Iran who are college educated, they have cousins or family, you know, back in some other part of the country who are saying, I'm not so sure. So Austin is right, you know, there's got to become a point where everybody's going to say, oh, we just can't get it over the top. But we have no example of this. The examples we have in the past are either the premature attempts of a mass uprising, which were put down in 68 and 56 and 51, I think it was in Germany, and more or less put down in 81, I believe it was, in Poland internally, to keep the Russians out. But Then we have the thing that scares the bejesus out of all of the dictators in the world today, what happened in 89, and then it's happened subsequently in places like Ukraine and Kyrgyzstan and a few other places, that, you know, the dictators of the world are scared, and justifiably so, because while there's a chance that this green revolution will not succeed, it's not a big chance. You know, if these guys are doing their calculation, they say, man, I'm on the short end of the stick on this one. But as I write most of the coverage on Iran, in Strategy Page, so I follow this, you know, day by day. What I've been seeing is the unrest has been growing throughout the country. Even a lot of poor people. And what's most interesting is the amount of, divisions, the degree of the divisions within the, as Austin pointed out, the bureaucracy, you know, the senior clerks, they are publicly criticizing one another. Now, we've described this in Strategy Page, you know, for years, you know, the various factions within the, you know, the ruling, you know, clergy, the guidance council. And it was always a question mark of how far would any of these guys, these dissidents, as it were, go, you know, in their dissidence. Would any of them, now, we have Mousavi, who is basically one of the old boys, as it were, is openly saying, you know, on with the revolution. And so you gotta wonder, are there any more like him, you know, hiding behind the curtains, as it were, you know, wondering, should I come out, should I? Remember, these guys are very religious. You know, they are of the type of person who basically practices what they preach. And one of the reasons why, you know, Khamenei, Khatami, oh God, all these, the names sound so close. Anyway, even Ahmadinejad, he got into power because he was one of the honest ones. He was also a nut job, as everyone found out. And one of the reasons why Ahmadinejad apparently lost this current rigged election was because he made deals with the crooked mullahs, the corrupt mullahs, because people expected him to clean house. He tried, and he couldn't. They basically told him, you come after my money, Ahmadinejad, and you're history. You're just going to, and that's basically what they told him. Just, you cannot do that, and we have the power to stop you. So he basically blinked, and now he's paying for it. I mean, even if this all calms down and he becomes a president again, it won't be the same.
Well, one of the things, there are a couple of things that won't be the same. We've seen the fissures publicly among the government, and not just the mullahs, but among non-clerics like Mousavi. And a little comment on him as a personality. He is an experienced revolutionary and a gut fighter. He is someone who is different. Now, Jim, as Jim pointed out, what we know about him, he is religiously conservative. He doesn't feign his faith. He regards that as, you know, let's give the man a credit for a sincerity there. But he also knows it's a political strength. He can't be attacked on the by the clerics as being a religious backslider. But comparing to the Ayatollah Khatami, who, as I said, was the accidentally elected as the protest vote. Again, I think it was 2000, and he was in power, I think, to 2005. Ayatollah Khatami is described by numerous people who know him, and he even described, I understand that one time when he was in New York at, I believe, a UN meeting, but he also met with a number of other religious leaders, is basically a philosophy professor. And he knows that. He knows, and a different kind of personality, very articulate person, but not someone who is politically experienced in running a revolution, standing up and doing the kind of very intense poker showdown with guns kind of calculations. It's that a leader like Mousavi certainly was understood in 1979 and 1980, when he was part of the Khomeiniist revolution. You do have the potential in Mousavi, and again, I'm saying it's potential. This isn't a prediction. Anybody said they were know what's going to happen on this is pulling your leg. But you do have some personal characteristics in Mousavi that make him particularly dangerous to the mullahs, which is, I think, one of the reasons that we've seen him manage to continue to show up on TV and have the spine to shoot his mouth, because some of his opponents know he's a tough player. Now, that is an outside analytic read, but I also think that we've seen over the last 2 weeks that that's the kind of character he's got. So, doesn't mean that he's going to be the centering figure for a successful revolution, but the potential is there, unlike some of the other quote-unquote dissidents that have cropped up in Iranian public politics, I think, over the last 15 years.
Yeah. One of the things I'd like to discuss before we finish up here, guys, is the Twitter effect. One of Bush's former advisors, I think it was yesterday, said that the Twitter founders should get a Nobel Peace Prize because they actually kept their system up when they were going to take it down for a while.
Well, also, I think it's a little inaccurate. I mean, Twitter is something the media picks up on because it's simple, you can focus on it, and it's easier to get the message across. Internet technology has saved the day. It's, like I said, it's internet technology that saved the day. Twitter was just one of many tools that we're able to get through. And not to take anything away from Twitter, because what it does very well. But in many cases, it was email, it was FTP, it was any number of things that were able to get around the firewall. That firewall they're using is very similar to the ones they have in Russia and China. It's basically commercial off-the-shelf stuff. You know, anybody can buy it. Mostly corporations buy it, but Iran bought it. And as Dan, he's our incident engineer here, can tell you, there are many ways to get past, you know, anybody trying to block you. It's much more complicated than football. But on the internet, the ball can always get through. That's what really made this different, is that unless you do like Burma did in, I think it was September 07, and Nepal also did, I forget what year they did it, they're the only two countries that have literally pulled the plug on all the internet. They shut down everything, internally and external access.
Now, my understanding is that because of the border situation with Turkey and some of the other Islamic states,
Iraq,
that some of those internets actually come into the Iran territory, and people are getting things out through those.
That's right. They have one main internet organization, but they have, I think, at least four different main trunks coming in. One from Turkey, and in other words, and that's because, unlike, for example, Burma or Myanmar, only has about 50,000 internet users. They have like less than 1.1% of the population use access to the internet. Iran is 35%. Nepal, it's like Myanmar. It's a little higher, a couple of fractions of a percent. And of course you have North Korea, which is even lower than Myanmar. There are very few countries that can afford to basically shut down the internet, because once you get to a certain point, the economy depends on it. So it's like Israel going to war. When they mobilize the reserves, the economy basically shuts down. You can only do that for so long. That's why Iran is so vulnerable to the Twitter effect. If you want to give Twitter some props here, you cannot stop the internet. China has been an ongoing example of a nation that's been trying to do it. They can't. Now, you want to get, that'd be something to do, Dan, is get some of your internet peers, and have a geekathon. Basically say, can we shut down the internet completely without just pulling the plug, entirely?
Right.
And as you just pointed out, it's difficult to even pull the plug in a country with such a high internet penetration as Iran, because there are so many plugs coming in. And you have satellite access. You have any number of ways. You just take a sat phone.
Let me make a quick point about Myanmar. BBC still came up with video. People were shooting video in Myanmar of the violence with their cell phones.
Exactly what I was just saying. The satellite phones. You can't stop the satellite phones.
But it was never clear, and I never heard. But I watched this on BBC's World Service.
Journalist friends told me how they do it. The certain types of satellite, maybe they all do now, but back then, 2 years ago, hey, ancient history. Over the years, the satellite telephone vendors, you know, added more internet capability, or, you know, packet switching, you know, capability. And now I think anybody with a satellite phone, the plugs are right there, bingo, into your laptop, and you're online. It's costing you an arm and a leg, but it can't be stopped unless, you know, the mullahs can start shooting down your, you know, satellites.
There's a workaround that Jim just described that we saw, and we saw work even in a very internet isolated, I suppose that's a term, nation like Burma. Second, if somebody wants to give a Nobel Peace Prize for the internet, why don't they go back and get the 24 or so computer scientists, mathematicians, that got together one afternoon and founded ARPANET. Those are the guys who are the real revolutionaries. Give them a Nobel Peace Prize.
That's right.
Give it to DARPA. I know that.
Well, them and Tim Berners-Lee, because he's the one who invented the World Wide Web, which made it a mass media.
Right.
That's where your Nobel Prize goes.
Right. Right. It's changed the playing field completely as far as this type of thing goes.
For the better, I think. You draw what out of Jim and Artmine, the conversation.
Ironic about that? When the personal computer came along and then the internet, you know, a lot of people said, oh my God, this is going to be the ultimate police state. But I and a lot of other people were saying, no, it's going to be just the opposite. It's going to make people free from the police state.
It's kind of a libertarian anarchy is really what it is.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's anarchy and it's out of control, and that's what's bothered, governments and police ever since, because it not only liberates the people, it liberates all the crooks and the spies and what have you, but, you know, that's the way it works. And unless you get to the point where the liberated, shall we say, you know, spies and terrorists and what have you do something really, really big and not, you know, beyond, you know, 9/11, nobody's going to make a big push because there won't be any popular support for such a big push to, you know, control the internet.
Right.
Dan, I think that's a good place to end.
Yeah, I think it is. And we wish the Iranians well and hope the bloodshed is kept to a minimum over there.
More green and less red.
Yeah, the Persian people are a great people and they deserve better than they have right now. So we'll end it there, and we'll talk to you guys next time.
Bye, guys.